Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, the 21st of October, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellum.
And I'm Christina Thomas. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith's 32nd season of entertainment presents Dromnium, now through October 23rd in the Breedlove Building. This original production watches as nine different lives collide, intertwine, and change through coincidences. Tickets and more information available at uafs.edu.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large, we go up among the hills with an Emmy-winning director and an effort to take a patch of land back in time.
But first, an aging reservoir southeast of Fayetteville is getting a much-needed makeover. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us there.
Lake Sequoia, just a few miles southeast of downtown Fayetteville, has long been a prime spot for fishing and boating. But in recent years, the lake has become so choked with sediment and become so shallow that geese tend to mostly flock to this place. Lake Sequoia, which impounds the White River, was originally constructed as a drinking water supply in 1958 by the city of Fayetteville. By 1972, the city was tapping Beaver Water District as a water source. So now the lake and park are used primarily for recreation and habitat for fish, waterfowl, and gray herons. Mike McBride operates a bait shop next to the lake and manages the boat launch. He grew up here.
There's catfish, lots of crappie, a lot of black bass, the smallmouth bass, there's a few of them. We got a good walleye run that's below the dam that come up out of Beaver Lake to come up to below the dam here. And there's a lot of white bass, so we've got a little bit of everything.
But channel catfish, once common, no longer can be caught here, says Billy Ammons, who also grew up near Lake Sequoia.
Many of the species that used to exist here just aren't here anymore. Because they can't survive in this type of environment.
Today, Billy Ammons is a regional manager with the global engineering, construction, and operations firm CH2M Hill. And as a contract operator for the City of Fayetteville's Water and Wastewater Division, he's heading up a project to dredge Lake Sequoia.
And I think that one of the biggest reasons is because of the sediment. Honestly, people are uncomfortable running their boats across it, so they can't utilize it like they once did. I mean, when I was young, there would be, in the summertime, even the wintertime, but especially when it was nice weather, there might be 50 to 100 boats out here on a Saturday.
Standing on a large open field on the southeastern lakeshore, 5 feet above the water, Billy Ammons points to two newly constructed bermed cells.
On one of them, there's a little, almost like an island in the center, that has a moat around the outside edge, upon which sits a large geotextile bag. We call it a geotube. The other beside it just looks exactly like a pond. It's a sedimentation basin that has, the actual walls are about 6 feet high from the floor to the peak. And we use material, of course, from the field itself, so it's about 3 feet below ground level to the floor of the initial basin and of the moat on the geotube basin.
This past summer, a city crew placed a floating dredge onto the lake and pumped 1 million gallons of slurry, a combination of water mixed with 10 to 15% mud, into the settling cells.
The dredge set about 200 feet offshore most of that time and then slowly came toward this location on a cable. And with a kind of a grinder pump auger down in the sediment that would allow some water from the lake to be entrained with the sediment that was being churned up from the bottom so that, again, could get to a concentration that we could pump and push through this flexible hose that was held by floats coming across the top of the water. Then came to the shoreline, went through a structure of pipe which allowed us to add some polymer to cause the sediment to flocculate together more readily, and then was introduced into either the sedimentation basin or into the geotube.
The clarified water's pumped off, allowing the sediments to dry out in the sun. Sediments deemed safe will be bagged and sold as topsoil, which will help to offset costs. The rest can be used for municipal fill.
So our intent is to make it a sustainable operation that is where this product is reused in place of other soil products that would have to be dug out of the ground, which we hope will help to eliminate erosion in other places and take care of the results of erosion here, at the same time protecting the entire water environment by extracting not only turbidity but also the especially phosphorus that is contained within this sediment that's here.
Phosphorus pollution has been a chronic problem in northwest Arkansas. It causes excess algae blooms that deplete oxygen and slime up streams and lakes with brown scum. Over the years, phosphorus-rich fertilizers, detergents, and poultry house wastes applied to farm fields have washed into waterways where it attaches to sediments and slowly leaches out. Heavy metals and nitrogen may also lurk in some of the mud, also from various non-point sources.
All of this sediment that's accumulated here is strictly from erosion that has occurred in the Middle Fork and the East Fork, or Main Fork, of the White River. There are a number of reasons why erosion occurs. I serve on the Beaver Watershed Alliance Board, and we're investigating or working with a number of groups who are trying to determine causes. There are multiple causes.
And although Billy Ammons declined to point to any specific culprit, construction, gravel extraction, and riparian destruction have all contributed to river surging excess sedimentation into streams and lakes in both the White River and Illinois River watersheds. When this 440-acre lake, now shrunk to 390 acres, was first constructed, on average, it was around 15 feet deep.
And the average depth now is probably about, 5 to 6 feet.
Islands of muck rise from the middle of the lake and are beginning to grow vegetation. Timothy Tinsley, operator with CH2M Hill, oversaw the first dredge conducted with at least 10-foot-wide by 40-foot-long hydraulic device that floats on pontoons.
And it was essentially a large vacuum system. You know, it had a bit of a tiller in front of it to kind of break up the sediment in the bottom of the lake and then vacuum it up and send it through the 4-inch line inland to either the geotube or the settling basin.
Tinsley said the test dredge this summer was a success. And Billy Ammons said it's the best ecological approach to cleaning out the lake.
And the least expensive method would be to drain the lake totally, pump it totally dry, allow it to dry in the lake, and then bring in a number of bulldozers and excavators and thousands of dump truck loads and make a big mountain of sediment somewhere, or, you know, dirt. We don't want to do that.
Once the project is funded and cleared to proceed, multiple dredging sites will be built around the lake. Although the pilot dredging is complete, the crew continues to pump clarified lake water out of the test settling basin back into the reservoir. Fayetteville leased the hydraulic dredge from Howard Sludge Technology out of Muskogee, Oklahoma for the project. But to cut costs, the city's water division is looking at possibly purchasing a dredge, said Billy Ammons.
We will evaluate that, whether to go with subcontractors or city-owned equipment, and determine what is the most cost-effective solution for the city. There are some potential alternatives that could involve some ownership and some rental, and we'll just have to put a pen and paper to it and see which works out to be the best case scenario.
Representatives from another municipality have already visited the dredge site, and more are expected. Perhaps an opportunity for the city of Fayetteville to loan idle dredge equipment for a fee. Arkansas has more than 160 freshwater lakes, most of them artificial, like this one. And learning how to maintain the health of aging reservoirs is critical, said Billy Ammons and his team, to recreation, habitat, and most of all, human consumption. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Along with kayaking, canoeing, and fishing, Lake Sequoia has two nature trails, the King Fisher Trail, which extends north from the Bait Shop boat dock parking lot, about 1.5 miles along the east bank, and a newly constructed trail leads hikers across a pasture to an informational kiosk, then about 1.5 miles along the southern bank. If you'd like to learn more about Lake Sequoia, you can go to accessfayetteville.org.
If you walked the trail at Lake Fayetteville on a cloudy morning late last month, maybe you heard the sounds of a chainsaw through the trees and brush. But good luck finding the source. About six or so volunteers have been asked by the park officials to leave no evidence of their entrance into the woods. David Chapman, one of the guys wielding a chainsaw, explains what the group is out here doing.
Well, I'm doing conservation work, I suppose, is the way to describe it. You know, we're trying to restore this in old prairie, which it used to be. And there's a lot of work needs to be done, cutting down invasive timbers and clearing and all this sort of thing. So we've been working on it for 3 or 4 years now.
The we Chapman is referring to is the Fayetteville Natural Heritage Association, or FNHA, a nonprofit whose mission is to identify and protect Fayetteville's most important natural areas, as well as the community's tree canopy. Places like the Mount Sequoia Woods and this land, located inside a portion of the circular trail at Lake Fayetteville. This area was identified as upland prairie during the group's green infrastructure planning. One of FNHA's board members got together with the superintendent for the City of Fayetteville's Parks and Recreation Department to develop a plan to restore between 30 and 40 acres to natural prairie habitat. But what is a prairie?
Well, it's grassland. It's ancient grassland. Not what we see when we drive around, I'm afraid. You know, these are the original prairie with lots of characteristic plants associated with it, and there's remnants of it here, and that's why this work's being done here. But in northwest Arkansas, there are very few places where you've got genuine prairie still left. Most of them have been plowed or reseeded or treated with herbicides and this kind of thing, you know. So it's a fairly unique place here, especially being within the bounds of the city of Fayetteville and also close to Springdale. So
the group is out here chopping down cedar trees and black cherry trees, clearing the way for the city to use herbicides on one of the most invasive grasses, Lespedisa sericea, which looks like something a farmer might chew on. The city also uses controlled burns, they've had three so far, to clear the way for the native plants to resurface. Bob Koch, chairman of FNHA, says lack of fire is one of the major causes for the disappearing prairie.
This is what naturally happens when you don't have fire. You know, in the olden days, this area would burn every couple years, and that would restore the prairie and keep the invasives out. But when man came in here, he made sure that fire didn't happen. And so the invasives, like the cedar trees, started taking over. And we have aerial photographs from like 1940 on, showing that like in 1940 there weren't many cedar trees out here at all. But by 1999, the place was just covered with them.
Dwayne Walchin, FNH member and Workday organizer, points out some of the native prairie plants.
This one is Indian grass, and that's a native grass. And this one is switchgrass, which is also a native grass. And that's my two native grasses, and you see goldenrod, the plants that are beginning to show a little yellow in places and a lot in other places. And as we walk around through the seasons out here, we see all kinds of small patches of plants that are native. And by improving the habitat out here, those plants will spread from those vestige populations to become much more dominant. And
they have already been successful on one patch of land. Part of the hope is that as the native plants return, so will the animals. David Chapman, a poultry scientist by day, says you'll get prairie types of birds, meadowlarks, bobolinks, and certain sparrows.
I'm not an expert on anything else. I did see two very large rat snakes yesterday, and I actually even flushed a pair of horned owls from this grove of trees here. So it's the sort of place where horned owls would nest.
Dwayne Walchin says a lot of the animals that will return will be rodents, mice, and ground-burrowing animals. He also comments on what you won't see.
I was stopped one day by a couple of young ladies who were on the paved trail as we were coming out of the woods, and she was asking me what we were doing. I told her about it, and she says, "Oh, will buffalo be back?" I said, "No, I'm sorry. I don't think buffalo will be back." But that's the type of animal that would have been here. And also, there were eastern elk, which were habitants of this area. And We don't expect to see those either, but quail, and particularly the birds, are going to enjoy a major comeback because of this diversity that they've got here now.
Bob Cox says that this is a project that will never be finished. They must maintain the prairie year after year. He does hope that within a couple of years, the city's environmental center, which is located nearby, can begin to bring students here.
To show them how the areas like this go into succession, going from prairies to savannas, then into the thick forest as you move back in. And so this has been developed with input from them so that they can use this as part of their educational program.
Also part of this plan is to work with the city to develop signs to place along the trails. Signs teaching of the natural history of this area, this particular restoration process, as well as the people history of this property. Last month, in order to foster enthusiasm and support, this project got a name, Callie's Prairie.
Mrs. Henson, Sarah Catherine Callie Greg Henson.
Callie grew up in the area, though her family fled during the Civil War.
When she came back to the area, is reputed to have said when she came back through this area that, "I love this area, I want to live here." And so 6 years later, her family, or her husband, bought the land and they moved here and lived here. And actually, the family continued to own land in this area until about 1941. 1948, just before the city bought the property to build the lake.
He says that whether or not she really said that, it sure sounds romantic. Also romantic is the success of Lake Fayetteville Park and Callie's Prairie. David Chapman confirms.
And I mean, this has been an unbelievably successful project here, because when they open the Hardtop Trail, I mean, hundreds of people use it. And so I talk about it as being the jewel of the park system. And you know, there's a fine balance between giving the public what they want, you know, so they can walking around and everything like that, and also saving the natural habitat that's here.
If you'd like to help preserve that habitat, Fayetteville Natural Heritage Association holds regular work days on the prairie. To find out more, visit fayettevillenatural.org.
This is Weekend Sunday Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
On Friday evening, the premiere of Up Among the Hills, the documentary about the history of Fayetteville by Larry Foley, was shown at the Fayetteville Public Library.
Quite the event.
Quite the event. It was a sold-out premiere event. Before that event took place, Antoinette Grajeda and I talked to Larry Foley after the film had already been completed.
It's in the can, as they say.
And that literally means that it's...
Well, when you shot things on film, we still call, you know, it a film. But there was a time when you finished a film and it physically went inside a can. But we still use the phrase.
Well, it's done, so you can't do any more to it because it's, well, in Florida. But is there something that was left out that you want to put back in, or things that you're rolling around in your head now, like, oh, I should have done this, or I should have done that?
No, you can't really be that way. My feeling, excuse me, I'm fighting allergies. My feeling is that you do the very best you can with what you have to work with and the time that you have and the resources that you have. But I want to tell you guys that I'm awfully, awfully proud of this film. I'm proud of the work that we all did on it, and I had a very creative team. You know, we worked on this thing for over 2 years, and it's a fun film. At times it is funny, at times it's poignant, but I'm really proud of it. You know, I think that's the way you want to feel when you're finished with it. Now, could we have continued to have messed with it? Well, of course, but there's another phrase that it's time to put the baby to bed, which in our case meant it's time to ship it off to Florida.
One of the members of the creative team, the narrator, President Bill Clinton, what was it like to work with him? Did you ever have to, because I imagine a lot of this was done digitally, like you'd suggest something and it would come back. Did you ever have to say, well, I'd rather you do it this way? And was that at all?
Well, what happened was we were going to go at spring break, and he didn't have time. He's a very busy man, you know.
Really?
He's incredibly busy.
Who knew?
And so we were going to fly to New York, and just before we got on the plane, we were told, don't get on the plane. The president woke up with no voice. And you know, Bill Clinton has this issue.
Right.
And so we went back about 3 weeks later, and we were set up inside of his Harlem office because he just didn't have time to go to an audio studio. So Hyatt Tuchev, my director of photography and editor, and I were there in his Harlem office waiting on Clinton to come down the hall and to be able to do the narration. And I did ask myself, Kyle, you know, now what if he doesn't read it exactly right, you know, well, of course, I had him read a few things over, you know, and he was most gracious. And the fun parts of that afternoon when we worked with President Clinton to do the narrative happened when maybe an ambulance would drive by, there was some kind of commotion, or he would get choked, and he stopped and told a few stories. And that was really pretty cool.
I bet.
Now, this film focuses on the history of Fayetteville, and you're very familiar with this town. You've lived here for some time. Do you think it would have been different if you were asked to do a film on a place you were unfamiliar with? I mean, is there?
I think it's always the same. You know, there are times when I feel like my target audience might be people who know a lot about the subject matter. Mm-hmm. That was certainly the case when I did 22 Straight a number of years ago. For me, it's like I knew a lot about the 64-65 Razorbacks. And sometimes I kind of felt like my target audience might be the guys that played on the team, to tell them a few things. So I certainly, one of my endeavors was to launch into some stories and some characters that I had heard about or in my research had picked up on. But I think if somebody has lived here their entire life and has never been anywhere else, I still think they're really going to enjoy this film, and they're going to learn a few things about some folks they didn't know anything about. I'm looking at this film as a story of the character of Fayetteville as told through the characters of Fayetteville, from folks who were here in the early 1800s to some of the Civil War stories, to folks after the Civil War during Reconstruction, to the turn of the 20th century and the middle part of the 20th century on up until today. And one thing about this funky little town of Fayetteville, we have no shortage of characters, and we have always had a great wealth of them. And that made it a lot of fun.
When one of your films premieres, what are you doing? Do you watch the film primarily? Do you kind of spy around?
No, I've already seen it. I
know that.
I watch them. I watch people, and I'm watching to see if they're getting it where I wanted them to get it. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they get it in a different place. So I like to sit at the back of the room and just hope and pray that it sounds and looks like we want it to in the presentation, because, you know, you're literally vulnerable to the technical gods when this kind of thing happens. So I like to sit back and see if people get it. That's what I like to do.
And you've done so many of these documentaries. Do you constantly have 10 ideas in your head, or do you focus on this one and then as soon as this one's done, it's maybe some downtime and then you start thinking about your next project?
Well, I don't have downtime, frankly. I have three films that are coming out and another one that's in production. So, you know, there's no shortage of good stories to tell, and I tend to be seduced by them for whatever strange psychological malady that I have. But I like working on these things, you know, and I'm really just – I really am attracted to interesting characters and interesting stories. You know, this business that I'm in, that I kind of made up for myself years ago, which is strange enough, is kind of like playing golf. I mean, you know, you can go out on the golf course and you can find 90-year-old people playing golf, and I may be one of them one of these days. But, you know, there's no age limit to, you know, storytelling. Storytelling is endless, and it's age old. And I just happen to like telling stories where I have the opportunity to weave the written word with the visual image, and sometimes the still picture and the sounds. And one of the things that's different about Up Among the Hills is that it's like a little movie. You know, there are a lot of dramatic recreations of when the Butterfield stage came into town, and on board was Waterman Ormsby, the young New York Herald reporter. And there's the story of the old scout, Charles Von Berg, playing his bugle on the East Mountain, playing taps every evening. And there's, you know, Miss Sophia Sawyer and her Fayetteville Seminary. So it literally is like a little movie. And one of the things that's been great about this project, commissioned by the Fayetteville Public Library, is that here's what I got. We want you to do the story about Fayetteville's history. Now go do it. Oh, my, was that fun.
Gosh, it would almost seem a little bit pressure, though.
Well,
but I guess
mean,
you kind of feel pressure every time because you want to get the story.
You know what? The way I look at that, Kyle, is that my reputation is on the line every time I accept a commission. One bad one and that's the end of you. So, yeah, I mean, there's always that. You just do the best you can with what you have to work with. And, you know, I'm looking for teammates. And I do want to mention a few people who worked on this film with me. Hyatt Tuchev is director of photography and the editor. Beth Mack Lewis is the associate producer. I had current and former students, people like Brian Campbell, who we brought in to do a lot of effects for us. Trey Marley did some additional photography and did a fabulous job. I have like 16 different voices in this film. So the one thing that was common about all of us, whatever phase they worked on inside the production of the film, is everybody was really into it and everybody really wanted to do their very best. And I think I told Hyatt this today. Hyatt, this is the best work you've done to date. And it really is good. But I would probably say that about everybody that worked on this, as far as I know of their work.
This weekend, as we talk here, this weekend you were awarded an Emmy. You're a multiple Emmy winner. Seven? Eight?
Five.
Five.
Just five.
Just five.
Just five.
Where do you keep them?
Well, some of them are in my office at the university, and some end up being at home.
Every once in a while, I
bring them, you know, I mean, they're little angels, so sometimes they turn into Christmas decorations for the holidays.
Right.
Ultimately, we'll end up on AETN and UATV, but there will be several upcoming free public screenings for folks to get the opportunity to see the film in its entirety at the Fayetteville Public Library, which is a fabulous place to screen. Great system.
Will people be able to eventually get this on DVD?
Yes, DVDs are being pressed even as we speak, and they will be available through the Fayetteville Public Library.
Are there DVD extras?
There are extras, as a matter of fact. Beth Mack did a film called Memories Up Among the Hills, and that's a series of interviews with some folks who have a long history in Fayetteville. A couple of them have passed away since we did the production. Mm-hmm. Andrei Dumchev, who was a Russian exchange student, did a little film called Fayetteville to You that won a contest. And at the end of the film, we have a few outtakes.
Excellent.
Fun.
And one of them involves Bill Clinton.
All right.
Perfect.
All right. Worth the DVD right there.
Absolutely.
We do know November 1st and November 6th are free screenings at the Fayetteville Public Library. There might be an additional date as well.
I think that there probably will be additional dates. And you know, I look forward to that. I'm hoping to attend all of them. Let's just hope people enjoy the film as much as I enjoyed putting it together.
All right. Thank you, Larry.
Well, thank you, guys.
Larry Foley is the director and a producer of the new documentary, Up Among the Hills. It's a history of the city of Fayetteville. Larry talked with Antoinette Grajeda and me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio earlier this month.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Katie Henriksen, host of Note, Monday through Friday, and on Sundays, Sunday Symphonies. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. We have I've got two symphonies picked out. They're both Symphony Number 2 from each composer. One's Philip Glass's Symphony Number 2, which was composed in 1994, and it was commissioned by the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And then the other one is from the Russian composer Alexander Borodin, and that's his Symphony Number 2 in B minor. He also, something I found fascinating with him is that he was also a doctor and chemist and an advocate for women's rights.
Okay. All right. And what time period was that, you said?
Borodin is a Russian romantic composer. His dates are 1833 to 1887. I don't know specifically what year he composed Symphony No. 2, although he did have revisions from two other composers, Glazunov and Rimsky-Korsakov, both worked with him on revising that specific symphony. And he was also part of this group of Russian composers called the Five, or the Mighty Handful.
Well, I guess they were, I mean, a lot to handle then.
You know, I actually don't honestly know a ton about that group. I was just reading about his life, and he was a member of that circle, and I actually don't have the other composers written down, but they were Russian composers who were actually trying to make music, classical music, that was more Russian than, like, not derivative so much from the other European styles is what they were trying to do. So.
Well, I mean, and maybe they were a handful because you said he was an advocate for women's rights. And in the mid 1800s.
That's very progressive. And it also, right. He also helped, he was the founder of the School of Medicine for Women in St. Petersburg. So he founded a school for women to study medicine in the 1800s,
right,
in Russia.
Right.
So
I bet, yeah, I bet that's,
yeah,
it.
And then the Philip Glass, it's...
That name I definitely know.
Yeah, yeah. It was commissioned by the Brooklyn Academy of Music and premiered by the Brooklyn Philharmonic. And this is a recording, actually, though, from the Vienna Radio Symphony Orchestra. I was reading up about this symphony, and he's talking, there's a quote from Philip Glass in the liner notes about polyphony, and that's, I know polyphonic is how usually people talk about it. So let's see. He says, I'm more interested in the ambiguous qualities that can result from polytonality, how what you hear depends on how you focus your ear, how a listener's perception of tonality can vary in the fashion of an optical illusion. We're not talking about inventing a new language, but rather inventing new perceptions of existing languages.
So it's just, it all depends on how you hear it, each individual. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so that's two symphonies tonight.
Yes.
And then tomorrow... We
starting
start
our fall fundraiser tomorrow, right. And during that time, I will be doing live classical music from 9 to noon. So if anyone wants to hear a specific piece, you're really in love with a Chopin nocturne or whatever, you should find me on Facebook or Twitter, or you could call us up at KUAF and let me know. I'd love to play something for you guys.
Right, great. Okay, and you'll be on air pitching with Kyle tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then we'll be together on Tuesday.
All right.
Okay. Until
teamwork.
Then.
Teamwork. All right.
Thanks, Kitty.
Thanks.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large, and October is, the entire month, is KUAF's fall campaign.
It is.
Every gift to KUAF during this month goes toward our goal. So thanks to everyone who has done so far. You can do so right now.
KUAF.com.
Right. Now, tomorrow morning, we'll make it even easier. We'll have the phone set up, and we will start our fall fundraiser at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. In the spirit of giving, this week's Ozarks at Large montage, songs, movie scenes that are about giving.
Give a little bit, oh, give a little bit of your love to me. I'll give a little bit, I'll give a little bit of my love to you.
Pete, where did you find this?
I was in Gary and I saw it in the surplus store and I said, that's gotta be yours.
This is unbelievable. Pete, I don't know how I'm ever gonna thank you.
That's me. That's me. And that's three people. And I'm going to help them. But it has to be something really big. something they can't do by themselves.
Once there was a tree, and she loved a little boy. And every day the boy would come and he would gather her leaves.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right.
To see how you did on our Give montage, go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
It is Sunday, October 21st, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So what you told me your favorite holiday.
My favorite holiday is Memorial Day. My second favorite is Labor Day.
Okay. Christina?
Christmas?
Okay. Well, we've struck out here because my favorite is Halloween.
Okay. That's fair.
And there's cool stuff going on, and we've got four of them to talk about.
Okay.
Rogers Historical Museum, as always, has decorated the Hawkins House as a house in mourning.
Right.
This one is set at the turn of the 20th century when there was a funeral for Mr. Hawkins in 1914. And they'll show that during that time, the deceased would lie in state in the home. Clocks would be stopped at the time of the death to symbolize that time has stopped for that person.
Huh.
And they covered the mirrors immediately with black fabric.
I've seen that, you know, in movies and in photographs. What was the idea behind that?
It's because they thought if you saw the reflection of the deceased in the mirror, then you too would pass away.
Oh, that sounds very urban legend.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's an old urban legend.
Right.
Right. A rural legend, as it were.
Of course, there were funeral customs like mourning clothing and mourning jewelry, and the widow didn't do anything frivolous for a year. It had stationery with black border around it. You'll see all these things at the Hawkins House. There are daytime tours through November 3rd, but there are two evening tours planned with interpreters dressed as a woman in mourning and as an undertaker. Hours are 10 to 5, Monday through Saturday through November 3rd at the Rogers Historical Museum. The candlelight tours are October 26th and 31st. It's all free.
Just show up.
Well, the candlelight tours, you need to register at 621-1154. Then there's the Voices from Eureka Springs Silent City. The Eureka Springs Museum visit to the cemetery, which is a lot more fun than it might sound like.
Mm-hmm.
Some really interesting people buried in Eureka Springs.
I like cemeteries.
I do, too.
I do, too.
Yeah. I do, too.
Well, if you grew up in Fayetteville, you grew up going to Evergreen for picnics.
Right.
And so anyway, they're going to focus on the Civil War this year and talk about Civil War battlefield surgeries and that sort of thing. And a youth who joined the Union Army as a bugle boy, and he'll tell his story about how he ended up in Eureka Springs. And that happens at 5:30 and every 30 minutes until 8:30, October 26th and 27th.
Okay.
$10 for adults, $5 for children, 253-9417. And then we have one that's a family haunted yard.
I don't know what that means, I guess.
Well, it's somebody who fills their yard with interesting things. But this particular person...
That would be my mother, actually.
Really?
Well, yeah. But that's another story.
Well, this person lives in Fayetteville. Her name's Jonna Summers Bryant. And I should issue you the disclaimer that I met her doing theater in Fayetteville. So it makes sense that now she fills her yard with these things. But it's not just you go out and buy the inflatables. She creates her props.
But it's only once a year. It's not like these things are in her yard.
Right. No, she's not crazy.
That's why it's different than my mother.
Right.
Yes.
All right. Right. So on 5 o'clock, October 31st, they invite trick-or-treaters to come through the cemetery in her yard and pose for pictures with scary actors. And later in the evening, more scary creatures will come out.
And where is this?
This is in Fayetteville at 2893 Sunny Lane. Isn't that great?
Off of Old Wire.
Yeah.
And they're asking for donations for an organization called TeamWorks, which is a group of physical, occupational, and speech therapists who are working for children internationally.
That's great.
So there you go.
Do you remember where the Munsters lived? Do you remember their address?
Mockingbird Lane. 1313 Mockingbird.
Very good.
And if you want Something slow. No, it's really not any less scary. Into the Woods ends today at Bentonville High School Errand Art Center. This is what happens when the happily ever after isn't so happy for fairy tales. 2 o'clock and tickets are $5 to $10. And the King Opera House in Van Buren will show the movie Silent Storytellers at 5 o'clock today, and that's free.
All right. Thank you, Becca.
Sounds good. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has a report on yet another frightening festivity.
If you're looking for something to do to celebrate the Halloween season, how about a dinner party with some dead people? For nearly a decade, the Peel Compton Foundation has hosted ghost walk tours in October. This year, a new event called Tales at Twilight is taking its place. Connie Hendricks-Krall, the executive director of the nonprofit organization, says it was time for a change.
For people who are familiar with special events, there's a rule of thumb that special events have a lifetime of about 7 years. This one had run for more years. It needed to be tweaked. And after last year, we all sat down and realized that there were some real logistical nightmares. Cemeteries, I guess it kind of goes together. We'd been doing the walks in the cemetery, and then they would go over to Peel Mansion. Well, there's two problems with that. They have to find parking near the cemetery. Then they have to transport themselves about a mile away back to Peel. And if you had bad weather, forget it. This way, with the new revision, we don't ever have to worry about weather. We also don't have to worry about daylight.
Tales at Twilight will premiere October 23rd and is presented by the Peel Compton Foundation in cooperation with Rogers Little Theater. The event will feature dinner and performances by local actors. Dinner will be catered by the main event, and the menu includes harvest roast chicken with fall vegetables and cobbler. During the tour portion of the evening, guests will be led to specific parts of Peel Mansion to watch actors perform three short vignettes. Connie, who has degrees in journalism and history, conducted much of the research herself and wrote the scripts for the short scenes. One of the vignettes features Colonel Samuel West Peel.
I knew that I wanted to incorporate as much of the Peel family because, after all, the mansion is named after them. They were a very prominent family in the sense that they were leaders in Northwest Arkansas in the 19th century. Then when you throw in the fact that Colonel Peel's brother-in-law was governor of Arkansas and then later was a senator, it just really made for perfect history. I had done enough reading also to realize that Colonel Peel had been good friends with William Jennings Bryan. There's enough reference to that. I will admit I took a few liberties, but there's enough in the record to justify this. And as I researched William Jennings Bryan, kind of compared everything, I decided I would go with the year 1896 because that would have been the first time he was nominated for president. And there's a lot of similarities between that election and the one going on right now. The Midwest was going to be really the battleground then as it is now. So I put the three men in our parlor and had them reminisce.
This is just one of three scenes visitors will experience. Guests will be led into a room where they will see a frozen scene, which will then come to life as actors begin reciting their lines. Once the scene, which will last about 15 minutes, plays out, the actors will freeze again. Guests will then listen to a short narration at the end of the performance before continuing on to the next scene. A second vignette is based on the story of a doctor performing a surgery gone awry on a young girl with appendicitis. It features a bit of a surprising turn of events. The third vignette will feature Hope Holmes, one of the participating actors from Rogers Little Theater.
My vignette is where Mrs. Peel and her daughter Catherine are with two of the ladies of the area, I guess you'd say, or society ladies, putting food baskets together for the poor. And interesting, Mrs. Peel went through some really tough times when she was younger, and starvation was part of that. And she pretty much made that her passion to make sure she, her and her family were never in that dire straits again, and the people of the community were helped out as well. So she, that was her passion, is to helping the community, help feed the poor.
Those attending Tales at Twilight can help feed local people by bringing 5 canned food items or 2 non-perishable items to the event that will be donated to a local food bank. Hope is one of more than a dozen actors working on this event. The group touring the vignettes will be subdivided, so all vignettes will be occurring simultaneously throughout the house, which means actors will have to perform their scenes 6 times each night. Though it does require much preparation with costumes and rehearsals and installing additional lighting in the mansion, Hope, a self-proclaimed history buff, is looking forward to the event, which will showcase what life was like during 3 different time periods.
I think it's something that the community really needs to get on board with. We don't have anything like this around Northwest Arkansas as far as reenactments. I mean, we've got the Civil War over at Pea Ridge and various places, and that's great, but there are a lot of historic places around Northwest Arkansas that have stories to tell. And I think that this could be something that, you know, going forward, that other places can do as well. And, I mean, bring history to life. How much more fun is that, you know? it'll be great for the kids because, I mean, they sit in the classroom and they hear about this stuff. But when you can see it, I mean, like any movie or anything like that, it just pops off, you know, the page at them. So, yeah, I think this will be something fun. And I hope that the, you know, community can take a look at this and say, that's something that we could do with our historic places as well.
Connie Hendricks-Krall, executive director of the Peel Compton Foundation, says this new event will provide another way to celebrate the Halloween season.
I think it's a different way to enjoy Halloween. You know, for people that are real Halloween buffs, first of all, Peel House at night is just really spectacular. I think you'll just get a big kick out of that. The second thing is, you know, you just don't see live reenactments right before your eyes. I mean, you're going to be very intimate, because you're only going to be a few feet away from the actors as they stage that. And I think between the history and then what I call my fun vignette with the little girl, I think it'll just make for an unusual evening.
Tales at Twilight has performances scheduled for 6:30 p.m. October 23rd through 25th at Peel Mansion in Bentonville. Tickets are $25 for those 18 and older, $20 for 12 to 17-year-olds, $12.50 for 6 to 11-year-olds, and children younger than 6 are free. The ticket price does include a meal in the carriage house, and reservations are encouraged. More information is available at peelcompton.org/tales.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda filed that report for a daily edition of Ozarks this week.
And here is the writer's almanac for Sunday. It's the 21st of October, 2012. It was on this day in 1964, the Swedish Academy announced that the Nobel Prize in Literature would go to Jean-Paul Sartre, and Jean-Paul Sartre turned it down. The Academy decided to award it to him anyway, and Sartre continued to decline it. It's the birthday of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, born in Ottery St. Mary in Devonshire, England, 1772. Very ambitious young man. He was a journalist, tried to launch his own magazine. And then he was introduced to the poet William Wordsworth. They struck up a correspondence. They exchanged poems back and forth. Wordsworth encouraged Coleridge to focus on writing poetry. They liked to go for walks together, long walks. Though Wordsworth preferred to stay on the path, Coleridge liked to walk through the woods. To pass the time on their walk, they made up a Gothic ballad about a tragic sea voyage, which became Coleridge's masterpiece, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, at which point Coleridge's life began to fall apart. He became addicted to opium, which ruined his friendship with Wordsworth. And he had a habit of starting enormous projects that he could not then finish, a musical about Adam and Eve, a history of logic, a translation of Faust, a two-volume history of English prose, a brilliant writer and thinker who just wasn't able to finish what he started. It was on this day in 1879 Thomas Edison finally got the right idea for a workable electric light using carbonized cotton thread, carbon filament. Later improved it with a tungsten filament that would last longer and glow brighter. It's the birthday of Ursula K. Le Guin, born in Berkeley, 1929. Her mother was a psychologist. Her father was an anthropologist, Alfred Kroeber, sometimes called the Dean of American Anthropologists. He researched Native American cultures. And so Ursula grew up with Native American myths. When she was young, over the course of 10 years, she wrote 5 novels, none of which were published. Publishers thought the writing was too remote. So she began to write science fiction. And in the genre of science fiction and fantasy, she's been incredibly prolific for the last 4 decades, publishing more than 100 short stories, 20 novels, 11 children's books. Best known for her Earthsea books, a fantasy series taking place in a world populated by wizards and dragons. Ursula Le Guin's advice to writers was to stay focused, and if you have a hard time staying focused, maybe you shouldn't be writing what you're writing. If you lack motivation, maybe writing is not what you should be doing. If writing bores you, that's pretty fatal. Here's a poem for today by Julie Cadwallader Staub, entitled Midlife. This is as far as the light of my understanding has carried me. An October morning, a canoe built by hand, a quiet current. Above me, the trees arc green and golden against a cloudy sky. Below me, the river responds with perfect reflection, 100 feet deep, 100 feet high. To take a cup of this river, to drink its purple and gray, its golden and green, to see a bend in the river up ahead, and still say yes. Midlife, a poem by Julie Cadwallader Staub, used by permission of the author here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world. You can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Joy Biles, engineered by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Harmon.
I don't know Harmon.
Boone County, over by Harrison.
Okay.
That would represent the eastern edge of our signal.
Yes. Okay, of our listening area. All right. Yes. Well, thanks for representing Harmon.
That's right. I believe Pete Hartman's family at one point might have lived in Harmon.
All right. The Hartmans of Harmon.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. We'll have to ask Pete. We'll see him tomorrow because tomorrow is all hands on deck for the on-air portion of our October fundraiser.
Right. Tune in then.
You and I will be on the radio together, I think, tomorrow afternoon.
I think we may.
I think so, yes.
I think so. All right. Well, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Happy Sunday.